Mohamed Masoud Morsi is an Egyptian, Danish, Australian photographer, journalist and author. He spent almost two decades working freelance across Asia and the Middle East. He's also worked as an airline programmer, forklift driver and fisherman, established a photographic academy in Copenhagen, built a school in Phnom Penh and farmed rabbits in Egypt. Morsi published his first novel, The Palace of Angels, in 2020, and his latest novel, The Hair of the Pigeon, won the 2025 Dorothy Hewitt Award for Best Unpublished Manuscript, and it came out in April this year. Morsi, welcome to The Year That Made Me.
Thank you.
Now, you were born in 1975, and that's actually a number of years after the year that you've chosen as the year that made you, Morsi. So what year did you choose and why?
I chose 1967 because it was the year that my father left Egypt, and kind of in a parallel story to my own story of leaving Denmark to end up in Australia.
So tell us about your father's journey and then how that led to the year that at least created you in 1975.
So my dad, in 1967, there was the Six-Day War between Egypt and Israel. And my dad was told by the military they had enough from his family. So he was given the opportunity to get a passport and apply for visas overseas. So he applied for Argentina, Canada, and Australia. And the only place rejected him because of white Australia policy was Australia. Mm. So he decided he was going to head to Canada. And on the way, he went to work in Beirut. And in Beirut, he met a bunch of Danish guys on a holiday. And he ended up, you know, fell into a conversation with them. And before he knew it, one of the guys told him, look, on your way to Canada, you know, stop over in Denmark. You know, there's plenty of work there. I need to talk to my dad. So when you're there, just tell him to call me on this and this date at the Danish embassy. I'm telling you this as my dad has told me this many times, you know.
Yeah.
And so he did. And my dad hitchhiked from Beirut. This was back in the days of Gamal Abdel Nasser. So all of Eastern Europe were very friendly with the Middle East. Mm. And especially Egypt. And he made it to Vienna, got his working visa for Denmark in the Danish embassy. And he told me at that time it was located on top of a brothel. you know, 60s, you know. But the Germans wouldn't let him go through Germany because they already had enough immigrant workers. So they sent him back to Vienna. And the Danish embassy issued him with a written carte blanche to pass. He's actually going to Denmark. He will not stay in Germany. So he arrived and he got on the train again, and they gave him a train ticket as well. And he got to Copenhagen on the 7th of November, 1967. And I was born exactly 8 years later on the 7th of November, 1975.
Amazing. So you definitely come from a family of travelers. And in the foreword of The Palace of Angels, you thank your father for never failing to support you in following your calls for adventure, and your mother for teaching me that art bound in love is the most liberating form of creation. That's a beautiful sentiment. Could you tell us a bit more about your mum, Morsi?
So my dad got to Denmark, and a couple of years later, he went back to Egypt to visit family, and he never left Denmark. He got there on a Saturday and started working on a Monday, and that's how his journey started and ended there. Well, didn't end, but, you know, that's where at least his home became. So he went back to Egypt, and on that trip, he met my mum, and they fell in love, and they said, okay, we're going to spend a couple of years in Denmark. So they got married, and she went to Denmark, where she started working, same as my dad, at Tom's Chocolate Factory that makes Yankee Bar and Holly Bar and all this. But my mum came from a very artistic background. So my mother's side of the family is from Cairo. My dad's from Suez. And she was, and still is, quite a good singer, although today she's 88 and struggles with dementia, which is tough for everyone. But in her youth, she was a painter, a very, very successful painter. And my house here in Australia and my mum's and dad's house in Copenhagen, and pretty much every single family member in Egypt, you'll find one of her paintings hanging on the wall. And she had auditions in Cairo in the radio house for, I don't know if you remember, Umm Kulthum, one of Egypt's, actually one of the world's biggest sopranos. She passed away. They were trying to find someone who could sing like her. And my mum got selected for that. Mm. But then she ended up in Denmark. She went with my dad and we were supposed to go back, and then she gave birth. My sister was born 73. There was the Yom Kippur War. And then in 80, there was still a bit of insecurity about whether there would be peace with Israel or not. And we never made it back to Egypt because then Sadat was killed in 1981, October. You know, you go back and then the typical tale of diaspora happens and my mum yearning to go back. And there's a story that unfolds when your home becomes further and further out of reach.
Yes, yeah. So clearly that first trip in 1967 was the year that made you, in that it bound your family between Denmark and Egypt. And I understand that in your early years, you moved back and forth between Denmark and Egypt quite a number of times. How did that back and forth inform your sense of yourself as you grew up, Morsi?
It's really a very good question, actually. It's a big question as well. It has many aspects. I spent most of my younger years in Egypt. And then coming back to Denmark as a child, you're faced with this very intense racism at that time. You know, this is 70s, you know, and quite rampant. You know, no one really kind of talked about this back then. And then I would go to Egypt. It was like the dichotomy between acceptance and rejection. So there was these two worlds that I was growing up in. And up until I was about seven, I didn't actually speak Danish very well. So I had to go to a speech therapist to try and get better at the language of the country I was born in. And then through my younger years, it was very challenging, you know, trying to grow up as a kid called Muhammad in a predominantly very Protestant country in Northern Europe. Mm. So that had a lot of very strong challenges as a young man. So that's where my dad comes in again. You know, as I was 14, I said to him, I'm going to go back to Egypt and go back and forth, and became the beginning of where my life became separate between two places. And it wasn't easy, but in that there was a journey of understanding my own identity. Where did I belong? In one place I felt at home, and then in the other place I also felt at home, but I didn't feel that I didn't matter, you know. And it made me very curious about also myself and what I thought of myself and why I was drawn to my tribe. You know, my tribe was in Egypt, you know, it wasn't in Denmark. And at the same time, I worked my way around things in Denmark, fighting a lot, but eventually coming on top of all that. And that was because of my dad. You know, if my dad hadn't been there to support me, I would probably gone down a road to many young second generation immigrants go through in that part of the world. You know, if you get the door shut in your face all the time, you eventually try and find other ways to assert yourself in this world. You know, we all want to assert ourselves to some degree, you know.
On the Year That Made Me, we're speaking with Mohamed Massoud Morsi. And clearly, Morsi, you had some really challenging times as a young man. And I think in one of your pieces, you've described it as a shallow and dark road, but you took a different path and became a photojournalist and also a journalist writing. Could you tell us about your relationship with making images and crafting words as a professional, but also as a younger person?
I guess I started with the passion of writing. I absolutely loved writing essays in English. I taught myself English with my sister using a cassette tape deck and going through phrases. So when we finally got to English classes, I was quite happy to sit and write. And I guess in writing and in photography, I found some sort of development of the soul, of the spirit, you know, of trying to understand myself and my place in the world. And when I went to work professionally, and I don't really like the word professionally because I think my career in journalism and photography has been very much a fine, probably not so fine, balanced by many standards, of being able to walk down alleys and roads and meet people that usual assigned journalist wouldn't really have that option of going down, which also have created the stories I've written now, you know. But what happened was like a growing. I was so used to the image that was presented of who Morsi was supposed to be. And this is what I despised with my guts, you know. It's like, I am not this picture that you are painting me. We, as in us immigrants, us Muhammads, and us people that come from the Middle East, we are not one big blob you cut over with a knife and that we all look the same on the inside, you know. We're just as human. And I was sick and tired of having to prove that. But I realized it's very hard to work against years and years of Hollywood movies, you know, watching Hollywood movies as a child and realizing that Arabs are just presented as very stereotyped. We're either stupid and speak with a stupid accent or want war, and all the populations are just mindless and they don't know art, they don't know stories, they don't have any background especially. They live in mud huts in the middle of a desert. And I think that drove me very much, because when I took the camera in my hand, I wasn't just another photojournalist. I was able to access people's homes that Western journalists couldn't access. And what I wanted to show was, within this world, there is all these other worlds as well that I believe needs to be shown as well and heard. And I guess the deepest part of that world was my own world, you know, that here I was taking what was really the white man's job and moving it in a different direction. Well, at least that was my idealist goal as a young man.
And it certainly took you to some extraordinary and extreme places, and you saw some just devastating things. Could you run us through some of the places that you worked and the things that you saw, Mozi?
Most of my work was for non-governmental organizations. At least they liked the work because I was able to get very personal stories. Mm. And then when I did that, I was able to kind of take stories and repackage them for newspapers, particularly in Denmark and in Egypt. I started off working in Lebanon, and then I went to Southeast Asia. I worked a lot in Cambodia with social and development issues, and shifted around the whole of Southeast Asia for shorter or longer periods, where I would go back to Copenhagen, pick up a job, earn some money. Freelance gigs are often very short, and to extend them into staying in a place, I liked that, but it required a lot of tenacity to keep finding more work and keep creating more work. And then in 2014, I went to Gaza, and then 15 as well, and then Syria in 15 as well. And it was really at that point, like through a lot of places I'd gone to, I guess there was something changed inside me.
Clearly you were seeing people in the most terrible, challenging situations, trying to tell their stories, and you were doing it in many places around the world, but you said something changed in you. Can you put your finger on what that was and what it meant for the work that you were going to do or the places that you were going to do it?
After 2014 Gaza, there was a moment when I went back to Copenhagen for a debriefing with the NGO that sent me there, or that gave me work when I went there. And I came back and I was standing waiting for a friend of mine in the street outside a fish shop, a fishmonger. And I looked behind me, and I'd written this very big feature, this story about this young girl that went to school. And the saddest thing in her life was this loss of her friends and loss of the fact that she could gather with her friends every day. And it was a really simple story, but the depth of the destruction and the depth of the loss, you know, the amount of child friends that she had lost, just a very human story. And that I think affected a lot of people that read it. But here I am standing outside a fish shop. I look inside the window and I see the fishmonger, this lady, she takes this big fat fish and it's quite slimy. And they have the pile of newspapers piled on the table, you know, next to the cash register. And she slaps this fish on this newspaper. And I'm looking at this newspaper and I'm, oh, but there's my article. There's that big, you know, that I just wrote 4 days ago. And I don't know, some epiphany, something happened there that kind of shut something inside me. And I guess that childhood fantasy of being able to change the world just kind of came to an abrupt end. It was also the realization that the news cycle of 24 hours is so transient, you know. We read something today and then tomorrow we wrap a fish with it, you know. But the stories in it, it's an enormous amount of work that ends up in a spread or two spreads. And you realize there's such a big story in those things. And I have a lot of respect for that kind of work, you know. But I realized I have to do something else. And it sat with me for weeks. I was just, the only thing I could think about was this moment, and it hit something in my gut. I still went on another trip. I went to Syria, and then I also had a trip to the Philippines after that for a typhoon. But I realized I have to take these stories. I have to do something else than this. I can't say I'm fully over going out in the field. I've still got that desire to understand what's happening in the world. But the drive is to find these stories that, I guess, brings us closer to each other than separates us. And that's been really the core of what I've done for all those years, is to say, look, there's so many variables and there's so many stories out there. And if we knew each other a bit better, we'd feel we belonged more to each other and we'd fight less, you know. And I guess that goes back to childhood. You know, I spent my childhood fighting.
So, Morsi, you've described going to lots of places, but we haven't got you to Australia yet. So tell us how it is that you came to be in Australia. And as part of that, I'd also like to hear, when did your relationship with Australia begin?
So my relationship with Australia began a long time ago when I was a kid. And I guess in that desperation of longing for acceptance in Denmark, I would look at these globes. Back then there was no internet, there was no YouTube, you know. Your idea of what Australia was, I guess, was Crocodile Dundee, you know, which is like a flat beer version of the reality. So I looked at this in my uncle's house. He had this globe, and it was a very old globe. And the story goes that he swapped it for a galabeya, which is the Egyptian male gown that is worn in the heat. And this Englishman wanted his galabeya, so he swapped him for this really old globe. And it didn't have Australia on it, it had New Holland on it. Which I thought
was really old school.
Yeah, very old school, you know. So in Denmark, I kind of made up this story that I'm going to go to Australia one day. I had no idea what this place was about. I had no idea why I wanted to go there. But for me, I guess psychologically, there was something. It must be so far away that in this place, everyone must be very cool to each other. You know, like there must be something very special about this place. I don't know. It's like this, you know, there's synchronicity in life. You know, we do things, we say things, we think about things that then come back to us 20, 30 years later. And you think, that's strange. You know, why would I end up here? If anything, it was just a childhood story, you know, but it suddenly became a real story.
You clearly had almost a fantasy of what Australia might be. I imagine the real place was a bit disappointing then when you got here.
Oh, look, so my good friend who lives here in Perth, Gregory Ruija, he's a son of an Ukrainian immigrant who fled Ukraine and came here, just like my dad had done. I met him across the world in Copenhagen at a rundown communal gym that I used to sneak into and exercise for free. And there was this guy, and he, you know, smiled at me, and I said to him, well, you know, where are you from? You can't be from here, because Danes don't smile. They really don't, you know. Like, Danes are very reserved people, you know. This Northern Europe, you know, it doesn't mean they're bad people. They're just outwardly, they don't say, you know, in Australia, you walk past someone, they say, g'day, mate, you know, and how are you going? But they don't actually expect an answer back, you know. So in Europe, you know, we get rid of all this. Why bother when you don't really care about the answer anyway? So this guy says, you know, I'm from Australia, you know, and we became friends. And at one point we were talking, and he suggested, why don't I come and spend some time here? And I said to him, you know what, I might actually do that. And this is back in 2009, I think. So I come here, my plan in the back of my head, I'm going to go back to Indonesia, where I lived back in the early 2000s, just before the tsunami. And I thought, well, I'm going to go back and see if I can find any of my old friends and the people that I had a very close relationship with there. So I spent a couple of months in Perth, and Perth is very nice, but it's like a country town. If you enjoy that, that's great. It just wasn't what I was coming to do, you know. So I thought, no, I'm going to go to Indonesia. I'm going to go back to Indonesia and bye-bye Australia. I've had enough of this. It's too bourgeois, too conservative, not my thing. So I got to Broome, and Greg in Perth had given me a number to a Greg in Broome, and he said, look him up, he can put you up for the night.
So you're doing a national tour of Greg's?
Yeah, exactly, which is so bizarre. You know? And anyway, so I go there, and the door opens, and I meet my son's mother. I don't know anything about bees and flowers and all this stuff. So a short relationship forms. And then I get to Darwin to get on the plane to Jakarta. And something kind of hits me, and I call my dad. I say to him, this has happened, you know, and here I am in this country far away. And I'm thinking of driving back. What do you think? My dad being my dad, you know, he said some very wise words, and he said, you got to do what you sometimes fear the most. And I guess for me, fearing the most was to actually stay in one place, you know. So I went up to the check-in. I said to her, look, I know I've checked in, but I don't think I'm going to fly today. So I left the airport and I drove all the way back, got a car, and I drove all the way back to Broome. And in 2011, my son was born. So it wasn't like a fairy tale, because I didn't want to stay in Australia. But I ended up here anyway, you know, because I decided there are just some things in life you can't take back, and that one of them is being a father to your children, you know. Mm. So that's what led me here. I joke about it sometimes. I say I'm a sexual refugee. I know, I guess some people find it funny, some people find it not so funny. I think it just shows there's so many reasons, like my dad, and this is why I chose that year, because like my father, something happens that is beyond my control, and we make choices in life. And I made that choice not to come to Australia because I had some idea that it was a land paved with milk and honey and gold on the streets, you know, but because it was a choice to become a father, not to do something in my life that I knew if I didn't do, I couldn't take it back again. And I'd already in my youth had probably done a lot of things that you can't take back. So that was the choice, to end up here. So it was a strange kind of initiation to Australia.
Morsi, you referred to something changing in you in terms of your perspective on journalism. Is that what made you turn to writing fiction? And given your multilingual background, I wondered why it is in your mind that you write in English compared to one of the many languages that you could no doubt write in.
Well, I write in English, but I think in Arabic, which creates a very metaphorical English. Like I liked English as a child. Jeg taler flydende dansk, I speak Danish, especially Deutsch, bekalam Arabi, and I speak English. You know, so it's four languages that run around my head like a steam train sometimes. And parts of my stories are written in Danish, you know, they're written in my mind in Danish, most of it in Arabic. But I find I take these languages and I put them into English and something happens with English. You know, it's like Kurt Vonnegut said, the best writers don't come from the English department because their English has already been sanitized, you know. And I don't know if, you know, the only way we know whether we can write or not is by writing. And I loved writing. I don't know if I was a good enough writer. My last novel, I'd almost given up on it. The Hair of the Pigeon that won the Dorothy Hewitt Award, I had actually almost given up on it. I just thought, well, maybe I'm actually not a good writer, and that's okay. You know, I don't have to be, I'm not comparing myself with the grand writers. You know? But there was something that I loved in the way that I had written both The Hair of the Pigeon and the novel before it, The Palace of Angels, is that it takes this Arabic metaphorical and very image-filled language and puts it into an English form and a way of writing that is not common to the English reader. So that was really what those who had read it said, no, you got to hang on to it, you got to believe in it, because that's its strength, you know, that's the strength of your writing.
Well, you certainly are a distinctive and fascinating voice. And gee, it's been fascinating speaking with you about your life, Morsi. Thank you so much for joining us on The Year That Made Me.
Thank you very much.
And we always finish with a piece of music. What have you chosen for us, Morsi, and why?
So I've chosen Asmahan's Ya Habibi Ya Habibi Ta'ala. In the novel, it's a ringtone for one of the main characters in the novel, Badawi's mother. And I chose that song also in the story because it really parallels also with a bit of a turbulent life I've had myself, but also the turbulent life of one of the characters in the book. The book is about fleeing. The book is about refuge as well as love and searching for home. And Asmahan was born on the sea and died in the water. And she talks about the tearing of the soul torn between love, where our love for home is and love for people are, which I guess is the theme of my writing really deep down without me knowing it, now that I think about it. But there's something very special about when you talk to someone about stories that are written or stories that are told. Often we don't know why we share stories. You mentioned a story I'd written. I have also written other people's stories. And I guess as human beings, it doesn't matter where we are from or who we are or what we have chosen to do with our life. Every one of us carries a story that ends with the same destiny we all share. We leave. But within this, we get kicked back and forth by all these forces in life. And I don't believe we all fully understand all of it unless we share those stories. And that's why I love writing. You know, you share either your own story or someone else's, but despite which one you're sharing, there's always a part of the other person goes into yours and a part of yours goes into the other person's story.
And here in its non-ringtone form is Ya Habibi Ta'ala. And Mohamed Masoud Morsi, thank you so much for joining us on The Year That Made Me.
Thank you very much.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.